Welcome back, everybody, to part two of our issue on federalism with David Melding and Glyndŵr Kenneth-Jones. Thank you very much indeed, both of you, for joining us. We were picking up the conversation around two different aspects. One is around confederalism and federalism. What's the difference? And Glyndŵr, I'm going to come to you first on that. And then I want to get into some of the sort of asymmetries of federalism and also international comparators. And David, maybe you could talk us through those in a minute or two. Glyndŵr, could you break down for us what is the difference between confederalism and federalism?
Well, a confederation is a union of sovereign member nations that, for reasons of efficiency and common security, assign a portfolio of functions and powers by treaty to a central body. Federation, sovereignty is shared between central and state governments. And each level has their functions clearly articulated in the constitution. May I discuss confederalism in some more detail?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, devolution involves a sovereign Westminster, in effect, delegating a measure of sovereign authority to the nations. Confederalism, or its more collaborative manifestation, which I often discuss, confederal federalism, turns this approach on its head, advocating four sovereign nations of radically different population sizes, delegating some sovereign authority to central bodies in agreed areas of common interest. In my booklet, The League Union of the Isles, I proposed an arrangement to stimulate discussion, a structure where a Council of the Isles, whose members are typically elected for a period of 4 years, could be responsible for enacting power on aspects involving defence, diplomacy, internal trade, currency, and macroeconomics, with an overarching committee of member nations convening regularly to discuss other issues which may demand some harmonisation of laws or collaboration. The head of the Confederation would continue, I'd expect, to be the British monarch, holding frequent audiences with the nation's first ministers. The National Parliament, of course, would assume every power not delegated to joint institutions. The model aims very much to continue our economic union through a common currency, bank and market, continue to promote our social and cultural unions through a guarantee of individuals' rights of movement, residence, employment across all nations with an agreed isle-wide level of basic welfare support, covering benefits and pensions. And of course, to uphold our joint security, defence is centrally held. For me, I mean, I think, you know, if I look at it from a higher level, it's important that we talk about our constitutional futures in terms of collaboration. How do we work together in whatever arrangement to the best of all whose interests we aim to serve?
Okay, so there's a very clear distinction there in your answer. David, could you point us to some international examples of what federal states look like and what you see as the pros and cons of how they're set up, or indeed confederations as well?
Well, I suppose from a UK perspective, the state we should look at most is when talk about federalism is not the United States, but Canada, because Canada has the nation of Quebec in it, and then the wider nation, if you're going to call it that, of Canada. It's also got a range of options in terms of the powers of the various members of the federations. It also deals with other issues in territorial governance, like the place of home nation, the other home nations, and the indigenous nations. So that's probably the best place to look. But I mean, Germany is an interesting example of a state that, you know, made a decision, partly enforced, as we said, after the Second World War, and then established this sort of new model. Switzerland has done it from the late medieval period, and sits between a confederation and a federation. So there are lots of models there. So I don't think in the UK, the fact that we would be a very distinctive looking federal state should be a problem, because we are very distinctive looking, or were a unitary state before we had devolution. And we have to, come up with our own solutions to the territorial challenges we face. But the central issue is, do we want a United Kingdom government to continue to exist and to be part of, and do we want to be part of that and part of the UK state, and also have our own rights in terms of national autonomy? And I think if you get that sorted out, you then, put in place the other sort of measures from the toolbox of the rule book, however you want to phrase it, of federalism. So I think that's the way to work. And the big constitutional issue we face, which is often overlooked, is that the people of Scotland came very close to leaving the Union in 2014, much closer than was anticipated. Mm. And there's still an active independence movement there that could well get over the line for independence. That cannot now be rolled back. There will, under those circumstances, have to be a second referendum. But we need to be aware of this incredible situation. There's no other state in the world that has as permissive a view of what is called secession, i.e. part of state leaving that state, than the UK. And we really need to think about how we're going to navigate this. Mm-hmm. And the best way to navigate it is to have a clear option for the Union in a form of federation, or then to say, well, under what circumstances will we allow a member nation to leave the Union, and what would follow, possibly some sort of confederal arrangement, as Glyndŵr has just mentioned.
So there's a very logical argument, isn't there, in terms of, well, if this is a union of nations that people were able to choose to join, then they ought to be able to choose to leave. There's a logic to that.
Yeah, but it's not recognised by any other state in the world to the extent it's recognised in the UK. Canada comes closest, but it does not say the people of Quebec have a unilateral right to secede. That very substantial Supreme Court judgment in Canada in 1998 made it quite plain that there were two peoples that had to make this decision: the people of Canada as a whole, of which Quebec is part, and the people of Quebec alone. And then you negotiate with those two concepts of a people. So, the UK is absolutely extraordinary in terms of being an outlier on this right to leave the Union. I'm not saying we can turn that back, incidentally. We are where we are. But we ought to do a lot more thinking about this, because we are such an extraordinary example of a multinational state that, contemplates its active dismemberment.
So that plays very clearly into your point before around, every federal or confederation, every federal state or confederation of states is unique because of the thinking that's got into to make them as they are. Now, the British Isles, and Glyndŵr, you're always meticulous about referring to them in that way, is, it sounds a bit ridiculous, similarly unique because of our history and what's happened over hundreds and hundreds of years, obviously, in terms of how we are and how we're organized. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a set of issues here around, well, what are coming back to those three options from the Constitutional Commission at the moment. There's, what is federalism? Do people understand what it is and what that would entail? And part of this series is about starting to unpack that through conversation. And then there's a series of questions, which is, so what does that mean around what happens next and what would need to be done, and what are the implications of that? Because we all know that that wasn't the case after the Brexit vote in 2016. There wasn't that thinking about, well, the implications are X, Y, Z, and they are going to be significant, whatever your view, those implications are significant. Let's come back to one of the key challenges for Wales at the moment, which is around inequalities. So we've got, and I don't want to get too much into policy issues here around, the Welsh economy, for instance, bumping along at sort of 74% of average GDP across the rest of the UK. But how would a federal UK be the answer to the UK's significant regional inequalities, which are particularly felt in Wales, with an older, poorer, less healthy, and increasingly shrinking population.
Oh yeah, look, you're quite right to highlight this. You know, Wales appears at the bottom or near bottom of all poverty indices in the UK. You know, we talk intensively about levelling up and north-south relations from a Westminster perspective, but few focus on the east-west dynamic, London-Cardiff or further. Firstly, there is the Barnett formula. I'm sorry to bring the Barnett formula up, which continues to underfund the nation. You know, Lord Barnett himself was ashamed of the mechanism which bore his name. You know, the block grant allocated to Wales experienced a real reduction of about 11% between 2011 and 2019, with funds decreasing from 19 to 17 billion. This reduction overshadowed a 7% real cut in the period for UK public spending. Recently in the House of Lords, it was highlighted that the Welsh budget by 2025 could be in effect £3 billion lower than if it had grown in line with GDP since 2011. So, yeah, there is a need for a new transparent needs-based formula to replace Barnett. Secondly, there's Brexit, which presents all kinds of problems. You know, we've had problems in the House of Commons in recent years regarding legislation being passed without the consent of the Scottish and Welsh parliaments. Between 2014 and 2020, Wales was allocated in the region of £2 billion from the European Regional Development and European Social Funds. If circumstances had not changed, these European funds would have been worth approximately £1.5 billion between 21 to 25. There's currently a shortfall also of about £750 million on this figure, which could top about a billion if losses from EU structural funds covering rural support is factored in. So we're facing, or we're approaching what could be termed a perfect storm, a perfect financial storm. And you know, the Welsh government has been helpful, has suggested solutions. It has pressed Westminster for greater flexibility in managing its budget, including increases to the limits on borrowing and cash reserves, and also the automatic ability to carry forward late-in-year block grant changes into the next financial year. With a case quite recently where Westminster took back, or the Treasury took back, £155 million from the Welsh Government's balance because it exceeded the amount Westminster allowed it to carry forward at the end of the financial year.
Between particular budget lines, wasn't it? Yeah, I think so. A number of issues in that mix. Obviously, you know, the block grant is historically, you know, the allocation of the block grant is made on what's been allocated historically rather than that independently verified assessment of needs. Mm-hmm. And Barnett has been tweaked, including by, you know, as a result of Jerry Holtham's recommendation to have a floor below which it will not fall. Interesting, we're having this conversation a week before my colleague Joe Rossiter gives evidence to the Senate around post EU funding in Wales and some of those issues around, you know, how much we've had historically in Wales, what it's been used for, and how it's given the Welsh Government the sort of fiscal headroom to do some of the large scale all Wales projects that otherwise it wouldn't have the funding to do, or the headroom to do, given borrowing powers and so forth. And the IWA has got a position on borrowing powers, and we think they should be increased. And there's a paper on that, Fiscal Firepower, published in October 2022, which listeners might like to go and have a look at. David, let's come back to one of the points that Glyn Doar picked up there around LCMs, legislative consent motions, which, so, you know, we've seen a number of bills with legislative consent motions denied in Wales being overridden, like the Internal Markets Bill. And we've seen an increased number of LCMs on big ticket issues, not on smaller lines within bills, right? So both the quantum and the range of issues that are being denied consent has increased. And the Institute for Government has got a very good visual of both the frequency of that and also the scale of that consent being denied more often. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you see that as a former parliamentarian within the Senate, and how that nitty-gritty of legislative work would need to happen? How does federalism help us to clarify that? Because a lot of that work is so it's so detailed, so esoteric, so niche that lots of people don't get it. Well, why would they get it? They're not doing it every single day. But actually, it sets out what is that unwritten constitution of the UK, which at the moment is being overridden very clearly.
Well, I think disputes about jurisdiction are, you know, the meat and drink, really, of all territorial governance. You're bound to have these issues. The advantage with federalism is that you would have some sort of constitutional foundation and a way of negotiating disputes with the Supreme Court. Now, get a bit of this now. The Supreme Court is a big player and will become increasingly significant, I think, and it's often overlooked, in terms of our constitution development, the role that's being played by the Supreme Court, which was only established 13, 14 years ago, but has already, made some major interventions in on constitutional issues. But in the federal system, you would hope that any attempt to shift burdens or deny the ability to act under the constitution and the powers that have been allocated to the different levels of government, you'd have fewer of them in the first place, and then secondly, there would be some form of arbitration and sort of neutral referees. So I think some of the criticism, there will be interesting to see if this continues, if more and more of these disputes go to the Supreme Court. The traditional criticism is it's the UK government that's judge and jury in its own sort of disputes. So you'd move much more clearly away from that. But it has to be said that in federal states, you will have a number of jurisdiction disputes before Supreme Courts all around the world. You know, in the US, this happens where the federal government is in dispute with one of the states and it goes to the Supreme Court as to, you know, who has jurisdiction. So you can't iron out all these things. It's just a matter of how you cope with them.
Thank you. So I'm conscious of time, and I want to sort of deal with one more point before we wrap up. The Constitutional Commission that's happening in Wales sort of sits alongside a commission on devolution that was commissioned by UK Labour and undertaken by former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, which has in its conclusions not talked deliberately, I understand, not talked very much about Wales, knowing that the independent commission here is taking place. But one of its conclusions is highlighting the need for that elected state senate of representatives from across the nations and regions of the UK with more devolution of power. So the whole scale revamping of the House of Lords. Glyndŵr, let's hear from you first. Do you think that, you know, there are arguments, aren't there, in terms of who might get in as the next UK government? But were it to be a Labour government and were it to enact the recommendations of the Brown Commission, does that push us closer to federalism, do you think?
I think it inevitably does, because greater centralisation within England and how that central decentralisation would relate to the functions of Westminster inevitably creates structures where the joint thinking between national parliaments as well as the regional areas of England need to be scrutinised, need to be discussed, need to be formalised, need to be shared in terms of understandings in a reimagined, should we say, a reimagined forum. I think a more ambitious concept of democracy is increasingly tested by our current unitary state, which is not underpinned by a written constitution, the less likely it is to be successful in acknowledging the autonomy, diversity, and the financial difficulties facing the nations and regions of these isles. And a change of attitude is required. You know, if you decide to devolve, decentralize, then you must respect what has been moved away from the centre, or accept the need for a written constitution to ensure stability and transparency in practice. And that's the strength of both federalism and confederalism. Parliaments are created to serve the people. Therefore, the concept of Westminster's parliamentary sovereignty is anathema globally, I would say. You know, indeed, it may be at the heart of some of the inconsistencies and the lack of accountability that we've seen in more recent times. So having more formal structures in place with clear understanding of accountability, responsibility, whether sovereignty is assigned to the nations or shared across the nations, it'll in effect put binding legal conditions on the way in which people act, where the way in which decisions are made, and where disagreements are resolved. These are structures that we can talk quite sensibly about today, but they don't exist in our present arrangements. So this is where David and I certainly would agree that the case for reform, change is increasingly being driven from within England. And the Brown Report, though I would have hoped it to be more ambitious, takes us into a space where those conversations will be had amongst the 56 million people of England. You know, just remember, England has five times the size of population of the other nations combined. And London creates 22% of the UK's wealth. You know, it acts as a strong centripetal force, undermining the position of the English regions more broadly, but simultaneously we need to look at ways of sharing that wealth and encouraging regeneration across these islands.
I want to come back to that point about the conversation that needs to happen with people in England, and also more broadly about what kind of future are we envisaging, just before we wrap up. But David, I just want to pick your brains a little bit here in terms of the Internal Markets Bill and the issues in particular from your perspective as a former legislator around what that told us and tells us still, and why it matters in relation to the consent issue in particular.
Well, I think it just emphasizes that you can have unanticipated challenges, like leaving the EU, and then there was so much of EU level governance that was technically devolved, though in terms of its exercise it wasn't, because we participated in EU policies on the environment and agriculture and regional development. And then when that gets unwound, where is the equivalent authority to what the EU used to do? And obviously the Welsh government and the Scottish government argued that that should all become devolved. And the UK government said, well, hold on, you used to believe in shared governance here at European level. It should at least be shared at the UK level. And they had the tanks to win that, the UK government. I think perhaps a bit more of a compromise would have been best, and we're now seeing some of the challenges, I think, Westminster driving it too much from the centre. But the real point is that any constitution has got to give you a framework and a rule book to deal with the challenges of everyday challenges of territorial governance. And you look at the various systems and you make your choice. And it does seem to me that federalism has a lot more answers than questions compared to the other options we may have.
let's pick up. Thank you. Let's pick up on some of those issues as we wind up. And it strikes me that there are going to be some fairly recurrent themes in this series of podcasts: issues around clarity, issues around accountability to citizens, issues around what's the framework within which we are operating legally in relation to that territorial governance, and what is the what are the processes for disagreeing and coming to an agreed disagreement on an issue, and what do you then do about it? But what's come through from this conversation, I think, in particular for me, is around issues to do with power and control, and vividly illustrated, David, by your comment just then that the UK government had the tanks to address it. I suspect we'll come back also to some of the issues around intergovernmental relations and working, and the systems that are currently in place in theory to enable that to best effect. But as an opener, thank you very much indeed, and an opener to this podcast series, thank you very much indeed, David Melding, Glyndŵr Cenedlaethol, for your thoughtfulness and your questions in terms of the issues that we need to be discussing. One of the issues being obviously the language that we use, and are we talking the same language, and are people who would not necessarily be involved in thinking about the constitutional issues recognize the issues that are being discussed. We at the IWA are firmly convinced that talking constitutional stuff isn't necessarily the way in to having that broader public conversation. People prefer to talk about what matters to them, and then how is that enabled and supported by the systems that are in place. So we'll be coming back to that in a later episode. But thank you very much indeed, Jochen Verrian, to you both. And we look forward to seeing you again on another occasion. Thank you.
Most welcome.